Hello and welcome to the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. Here we discuss topics, cases, and anything new and upcoming in the world of acute medicine. This is our view and take. Remember to always do your own reading around the topics we discuss. Enjoy the show. Well, hello there, everybody. We have a new podcast for you today. And joining me today, I have got Damien.
Hi, Vicky.
And I've got a slightly unwell Peter. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
You've got a deep voice, Peter. It's very nice for us to listen to, but I'm not so sure it's nice for you to have. And so we're recording today about the GERFT report. And I think out there, those people who are listening to this, there'll be a variation of people's knowledge on what GERFT is. But hopefully most people will now have heard of it. So GERFT started life from the orthopaedic perspective. And the little bit of background I'll give you is that Tim Briggs noticed that there was a massive variation in the orthopaedic world on how people were doing surgeries and using different equipment, and therefore they had different outcomes. And he looked at this and thought, you know, we really should standardize this. So put together this report and tried to standardize the world of orthopaedics. It was incredibly successful. It took off massively, and it's now been used in all the different specialties. There is some thoughts that you can't standardise unplanned care in quite the way that you can elective care. However, there is some traction with this in that, why are we all doing different things? Why are we all sort of treating pneumonias with different things and that kind of thing? So acute medicine have done their GERFT report. It's taken them quite a while, as you can imagine. They looked at 191 AMUs over 131 trusts and essentially came up with a report. They really struggled because of really poor, inconsistent data. And that is one of the big themes that come through this, actually. But it's an impressive document. It's 148 pages. And one of the reasons we thought we'd do this as a podcast is because how many of you out there want to listen? Sorry, want to listen to us? Probably not many. But how many of you want to actually trawl through that 148 pages, or indeed have got time? So what we thought we'd do is try and summarize it a little bit, talk about the bits that are interesting to us. And actually, I have to say, once I started looking through it, I did actually find it quite easy to read and really interesting. So it might just whet your appetite and go and read it in more detail. So how are we going to summarize this for you? Well, I thought what we'd do, that they've basically come up with 19 recommendations. So what we thought we'd do is just talk about the bits that just caught our attention. So with no further ado, I'm going to go to our slightly snotty Peter and his lovely deep voice and ask Peter which bits caught his attention and why.
Thank you, Vicky, for that lovely introduction. And I apologise if I sniff throughout the whole of this podcast. I'll try and mute myself when I'm not talking. Right, when I looked at this GERFT report, I was quite put off by the fact it was 150-odd pages or something like that. But I found it was actually a really interesting read when I got into it, and there were so many things we could talk about. I learned a lot about my own specialty reading this. And I'll start off by resourcing the AMU. I suppose I didn't really know how AMU should be planned in terms of resourcing. Because I felt like whenever I've worked else in various trusts, it's very different. There's a lot of variation, and I suppose that's what the GERFT report is addressing. So, for example, the capacity of the acute medical unit is meant to be based on your daily take of acute medical numbers plus 10% to allow for any variation in admissions and patient flow. I'm not sure whether you guys were aware of that.
No, I wasn't.
I was, but only recently.
Yeah, so I mean, certainly where I've worked, I'm pretty sure the acute medical units and are not based on those numbers, and it feels like the acute medical unit is just opened up on a ward in some places out of convenience rather than anything else.
I would agree with you there, Peter, because when you look at the structure of the hospital and the way in the Scariff report it talks about where it should be sited, a lot of acute medical units aren't really near the front door. They're not near A&E particularly. Some are either above it, some beside it. But some of the hospitals I've been to, it's a bit of a walk, it's a bit of a distance. And then whenever new hospitals are being built, are we thinking about that as well? Are we thinking about the structure of where an AMU should sit compared to their, say, their SDEC or their A&E department as well? So you're right with that.
And the size of the AMU, again, sort of, I wonder how many units have been planned to be that size, taking that into consideration. Or is it how many beds we think we can staff with consultants?
Yeah, that's right. And it feels like there's never enough staff for the number of beds. And certainly more beds seem to be popping up around the corner in your unit in some cases. And the number of consultants pretty much stay the same. And I think that's really difficult for a stretch team already.
It's not even consultants, number of juniors, number of ACPs, number of nurses,
PAs.
Your whole MDT, is that counted into the expanding exponential number of patients that we see in acute medicine?
So I guess that brings a bit of a tricky issue, because if you sat down with your departmental managers and your teams and go, do you know what, we should have an AMU that's much bigger than the one that we've got, it isn't something you can fix overnight. Yeah. Because to get that resource, well, I mean, there is a bit on workforce planning later. It's really tough. And that is something that I suppose it's worth bearing in mind. That's how big it should be. But practically, what can we do? And I think it's important to really look at that and go, to actually work this properly, that's what the recommendation is. But that isn't going to be one of the things that can just be fixed. It can be, that could be a target, a sort of an aim. But also, if it's reliant on the take, well, we all know what's been happening to that. So it's almost like your AMU number of beds is going to have to change yearly, isn't it?
Yeah, that struck me. Look, there's a great graph in this report showing that the numbers coming through the take seems to be increasing year on year. And I think it was compared to maybe 2011, it's gone up by 30% in 2019. I mean, it's ridiculous. The trend is just growing and growing. And we can't just keep on growing our acute medical units.
Yeah, and interestingly, however, I went to a talk recently where Tim Cook mentioned that although our number of patients coming through our acute take is rising, the number of patients coming through an A&E is not rising. It's quite static. But the number of patients that are requiring acute admissions is rising.
So what, the number of people attending ED is staying roughly, I've seen that same graph, but they're sicker and needing more.
It's a different population now than it was 10, 15 years ago, exactly. But it's an interesting graph as well that he showed us at a recent talk.
That probably reflects the change in population over the years somewhat.
Well, there's another graph in here, isn't there, looking at the age distribution, and it just shows what we all know is that we have an increasingly elderly population, an increasingly frail population, and that again is going to affect that.
One of the other graphs alongside that I found interesting was the number of referrals from number of admissions from GP referrals. Over the time, that seems to be static. But the report goes on to give some caveats why that might be the case. So, for example, some trusts apparently like all admissions or attendances to go via the ED department rather than a separate GP admission area, if you like. Whereas other trusts may have problems with blockages and flow. So if your GP unit is blocked or full, though any more patients coming in to that unit will have to go via the ED department. And again, that will skew the figures. And then the other reason that the report goes into is that patients are finding it more and more difficult to access a GP and so attend ED with for problems that they would normally go see the GP for.
Yeah, so that is a startling figure, isn't it? So I can't remember what year it goes back to. It's about 2011 or something. 50% of the take was GP referred, and it's now about 15. And like you say, that they highlighted all those reasons. And I think you feel that. And I guess that then needs us to think about the way that we plan the take for people who used to have GP assessment units and that sort of thing. That was a real sort of eye opener for me to see that change in that distribution. And I wonder how many of those patients, if they saw GPs, would have stayed at home, because GPs, for example, dealing with a headache in my experience, are much more pragmatic. They're much more knowledgeable in a lot of those things, whereas ED might be seen by an F2 and then get referred to a medical team. It's very different dealing with a headache, I think, in primary care compared to an A&E, where you've got a CT scan around the corner. You might make different choices. I've been to talks where they've postulated that a lot of those ED referrals will then, you know, result in a zero length of stay. So if they'd been seen by a GP, potentially wouldn't have been referred in at all. And it's about supporting our GP colleagues, because they're clearly massively overstretched as well in how we can sort of support primary care, because I think primary care are a huge asset to us, and they are just under massive pressures, and we need to be aware of that. But I think, like you say, that there are other reasons as well, aren't there? And that is that GP assessment units are closed, and so because they're all bedded down, so a lot of those patients are going straight through ED rather than the GP assessment units. But that's a startling difference to me.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one of the other things from this report that struck me was about coding. But just before I do go into coding, I found it really interesting the different services that AMUs across the nation offer. So, for example, there's a wide variation of acute medical units offering things like CPAP or high flow nasal oxygen. So I think I read about 30% of trusts offer CPAP and less than half offer high flow nasal oxygen. We all have different ways of monitoring cardiac monitors, so telemetry is a good option. I think that's recommended with a central monitor, but some units use bedside monitoring, and obviously that has its downsides. So nurses need to be present to be looking at that monitor at all times, or someone needs to, and that person looking at the monitor needs to be trained on how to recognize any problems, any arrhythmias, for example. And then enhanced areas, level 1A or even level 2, are sporadic throughout the country. So 20% of AMUs offer level 1 or above, I believe. And I thought that was just really interesting, but we all have slightly different services from our acute medical units, and I suspect that will change our skill mix as well. So my acute medical unit doesn't offer CPAP, for example, because it's offered elsewhere. I would struggle starting CPAP on someone these days if I had to physically put on. Whereas I'm sure some of my colleagues elsewhere might find that absolutely fine.
So interestingly, does that number of talking about patients that are in CPAP, is that patients that are newly started in CPAP, or is that, does that include patients that have CPAP at home and they're coming in and just using their own CPAP on the acute medical unit, which we, a lot of places do allow and do use, because it's set levels. So does that, is there a differentiation between patients newly been started in the CPAP or it being a routine part of their treatment?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I assumed that was patients newly started on CPAP, but I don't think, I don't remember reading it being differentiated in a report.
No.
Yeah, I'd agree. I would imagine. So, I mean, essentially they looked at this, because of COVID, they were supposed to go to all of the AMUs and then couldn't because of COVID. So that it was a mixture of deep dives, which they got a huge number done. I mean, the amount of work gone into this is massive, but they also did it based on questionnaires. Now, if you were asked that question, do you provide CPAP on your unit? It's how the individual managers or clinicians filling that questionnaire in would interpret it. So I would imagine, and especially given that the number's quite low, I would 20%, I would imagine that's people who can start up CPAP on their unit. That's how I would interpret that. But it is a good question, Damien. I didn't even think about that.
Because we do see a lot of people.
Yeah, so I would have answered that question as a no for the trust that I was working in at the time, that we don't start CPAP on the unit. But lots of times people who've got their own units would just plug themselves into their little portable machines.
Yeah.
That's how I'd have answered it.
You mentioned as well, Peter, about the level 1A areas or the enhanced care areas that potentially have this. Do you think that we're going to see a lot more of these popping up around the country in acute medical units, given that we've seen the release of the enhanced care framework recently?
I would like to think so. I think we're all lacking a bit of guidance on how to set up an enhanced care unit. I think a lot of acute medical consultants would be quite keen to have this service. Obviously, it needs a lot of framework and structuring around it and how to staff it, for example. So I think in answer to your question, I think yes, but it's going to take a bit of time still.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to set up one currently at the hospital I'm working at, and it's not the easiest things, like any sort of unit that you're starting off in a hospital. It's not the easiest sort of thing to definitely get set up. But I think we're starting off at probably a level 1.5 rather than level 2 at the moment, with the more sicker patients being in that area with like a 1-3 nursing. Whereas in the, well, we could talk about the workforce there, part of the GERF report at this stage, it talks about the nursing care, and in a HDU setting, it's a 1-2. And interestingly, it talks about the nurse staff in acute medical unit, which I don't think this has ever actually been in writing before, what is suggested for nursing care of on an acute medical unit. But it says, it actually gives numbers. So it doesn't give numbers for any other work staff on the units, but it does for our nursing staff, which is a 1-6 for AMU or a 1-2 for HDU within an AMU. And do we think that we're getting a 1-6 nursing ratio in our acute medical units?
I thought the figures on this were better than I'd have thought. So it sort of went up to a 1 in 9 in some places, but that was the maximum, and including 1 in 9 overnight. I wonder, when people have filled this in, is that how many they're staffed for before sickness? Yeah. Not reality, because they're two very different things. And I remember one trust I worked at going, you need more nurses, and then they showed me and they'd got loads of nurses. It's just that their sickness rate was so high that they were having up to sort of 25% sickness on any given day, so that impacts. And that's a really difficult thing to factor in, and we see that as well with medical workforce as well, don't we? So I think that there's a lot of work gone into that. I think the nursing reps on the SAM Council have been doing work on suggested nursing staffing ratios. So I think that's where this is being drawn from.
Yeah, not to be fair, fair dues to them, because that's quite clear and it's quite good.
Yeah.
And that there's, and I know working with our current sister and matron, that having a number
is helpful,
is really helpful for them. Whereas for the medical staffing, it's suggested that it has to reflect the needs of the population that serves in terms of age, frailty, comorbidities, and deprivation.
Yeah.
Which is different for every single hospital, every single trust, no matter where you're at.
Yeah, and that's a bit more vague and difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I mean, if you watch the nurses on an AMU, and the paperwork, because a lot of these are new admissions, so they have to do all the admission paperwork. And then if it's working and there's flow, then those patients are being moved out really frequently, and they do all the discharge from that unit paperwork, as well as coping with some really sick patients and lots of blood transfusions and heavy, intense nursing treatments. It's pretty huge, isn't it? So it's nice to give a number to it, and it would be nice to think that could be sort of abided by despite sickness, and also having these enhanced care areas would really help with that, because then you could put those sort of patients that are requiring that really higher level of nursing into those areas, and that would help the rest of the ward in a way.
Exactly.
Should we move on to Damien to see your take on it, Damien? Did anything jump out at you?
Yeah, so I got in the workforce bit there, because that I thought was interesting, and it was quite clear for that. The other part of the GERF report that I've noticed, and I think this is potentially Phil Dyer that's been leading on this, is the name of the different units. And I can imagine we've all been to lots of different hospitals throughout our training or working, and we've seen lots of different names for the units. I'll not put out names there in case Phil does get annoyed with me, but it's suggested that we should be calling it the acute medical unit or AMU. There's a nice part in the GERF report with what's the
word cloud,
thank you. And the biggest one in the middle is AMU.
Good.
And it is suggested that that's what we call that. What does everyone else think about that?
Well, I think this really links in to the coding stuff that Peter was talking a bit about as well. And for me, one of the thing that I keep going back to is that how on earth can we really sort of take our units forward, really look at everything across the country when our data is so poor. And if all the units are called something, and they describe this really beautifully as you go through the document, they also talk about it when they get to the SDEC bit as well, to try and actually work out what's happening. I mean, the amount of work they had to do, they had to sift through all patients admitted under all sorts of different things, because they to actually work out who's coming in under acute medicine. So something as simple as just getting every unit to call themselves the same thing, I think it's really important. I really do. And then they also talked, and this is a bit dry, but again, I think it's really important, and it needs to come from us to engage with our managers about the coding of how we're coding patients. And there is an acute medicine code. So if they're treated as AIM, there's a code TFC326. A lot of units aren't using that yet. And then it's different for if they're GIM. And again, if we all did that perfectly, it would make getting data so much easier. So I think it's important. Peter?
No, absolutely. I completely agree. It's important. I think the fact that acute medical units go by various names in different trusts causes a lot of confusion. So there's the issue with coding, as you mentioned, Vicky, but I remember as in my Take AIM days, and Damien, you were a Take AIM fellow as well, I'm sure you could relate to this, that a lot of people, public and healthcare professionals, didn't really know what acute medicine was. And if you can't even be unified in the name where we work, I think we're not helping the fact that people don't really know about acute medicine and specialty and what we do. So I think it is really important that we become unified and use the same nomenclature.
I do think it'll be a hard thing to change, though, as well for hospitals that have a different name. And if they're used to that and it's been named that for a long, long time, getting that hospital or that team to change the name, it is going to be difficult. And this report will help with that, that this is what it should be called, but I can imagine changing ways is a difficult thing to do.
I don't know, it feels like people are changing names all over the place all the time in different units for everything else. But yeah, and it is, isn't it? So hospitals sometimes change their name when they merge, or
hospitals do, and
patients will call them what they think that hospital should be called. But I think it is more important to change it. However, I'm not so sure about, well, I guess it is important that all ambulatory care / SDEC units are called the same thing. And it's very similar here because there's a huge level of confusion. But I get a bit grumpy about the term SDEC, and they do actually say in this document that SDEC should be called SDEC now, and we should be unifying that. My worry there is I can't help but think they're going to change that name again. I've heard them saying that they're going to call it same day. So that the SAM And RChem did put out a document a while ago now saying that ESTEC and AEC were equally valid names to call your department, and you didn't have to change all your signage if you'd just done it. But now the GIRF report is saying no, you should be calling it ESTEC. So I might just have to swallow my grumpy pill on that one, and just so, because I do think it's really important to call things the right thing. But whereas I think acute medical unit is the perfect name for the acute medical unit, and it is what it does on the tin, I hate the name ESTEC, so I'm less keen to agree on that. But I also think it's important to call the units the same thing, and so that patients get sort of less confused. But I might have just waited a bit until they finalise the name for that, because I can't help but think that's going to change again.
The other part of the report that I thought I'd talk about as well is what an actual acute physician is. It does. Oh,
I loved this bit. I thought that was really important, actually.
So it talks about the Society for Acute Medicine as well, and here that all consultants who are employed for more than 50% of their direct clinical time, if on an AMU, have the right to call themselves an acute physician.
Let's just debate that point then. So, Peter, what's your gut instinct to that?
I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it.
Me too, if it helps.
Yeah, because I've trained as acute medic, so I have the right to be called an acute medical physician. But then again, I know plenty of great GIM physicians who work in acute medical units, and essentially their job plan is pretty much identical to mine. I haven't decided where I stand on it.
Yeah.
50% in this report just seems, I don't know where they've come up with that figure, just because it's more than half, I suspect.
I find it difficult, having done the 5 years of training that we do in acute medicine, the acute medicine SCE exam, to then have somebody else that doesn't have that training or that SCE to have the same job title as us. I wouldn't necessarily go and work in a care of the elderly ward and say that I'm care of the elderly consultants. I can't work on a renal ward and call myself a renal consultant because I don't have the renal training. I haven't done the renal exams. Similar with emergency medicine. I haven't gone through all that training in emergency medicine or done their exams to call myself an emergency medicine doctor. But this report says that as long as you've worked in an acute medical unit, you can call yourself an acute physician.
Well, no, it says 50% of your DCCs have to be within acute medicine. So,
but without the exam, the training. So,
because I completely agree with you and Peter, but I need to be play devil's advocate because it makes it more interesting. The godfathers of acute medicine, the people who set all this up, didn't train in acute medicine. It wasn't a specialty, and we're still really young. So if you think about most acute medical units now that I'm aware of, and I think I might touch back on that again in a minute because I think there's such variation. But more and more of the new recruits into those units are fully fledged acute medics who followed all the training and have got the exam. But they started off with people with a vision, pure people who, you know, that they might have trained in a different specialty, but they would have been acute medics if they'd have just, you know, graduated a bit earlier, if it had been a specialty. So I'm the very first year in Mersey to do acute medicine as a specialty. So anybody before that wouldn't have been able to do it. And yet there's some people, and I can think of somebody that I have worked with previously, and he's just a born acute medic. He's got all the skills. Yes, he hasn't got the exam, but his entire DCC is within acute medicine. And he does a better job than me. It's probably not hard, but you know, so this is a really tricky area, isn't it? So we've got to be really proud of the fact that we're trained and what our training has taught us to do. And as it progresses, then I think this will change because there'll be more trained acute medics. And we want people to train in the specialty and really understand the specialty rather than just float into it because they haven't got a job in the specialty they trained in. But for now, we do have to respect that there's some amazing, innovative people who actually set up these units who kind of should be able to call themselves acute physicians, I guess. And it's where you draw that line. So somebody who does, you know, most of their job plan in a specialty and floats onto the unit for one or two sessions a week, no, I don't think they're an acute physician. If they've spent the last, what is it, 10 years on an AMU that they helped set up and have just done nothing but acute medicine, well, they've effectively done the training program in a way, haven't they?
Yeah, so it's tough. It is, and it is. I do find it a bit of a hard pill to swallow, and I know trainees that are coming through, there has been lots of comments of how, if we're doing all this training and we go to these different units and there's people that isn't actually acute trained on them.
Mm.
However, going back on that, exactly what you've just said there, there's so many great people that are in acute medical units that have set it up, that I have worked with that have taught me acute medicine. And I know the ones that you're talking about. So yeah, it's hard to say that, but then at the same time, I agree exactly with what you've just said there. There is great, and they have been the ones that have trained us up.
And then, so I was touching on the difference in units, and they talk about that this a little bit in here as well. And we've got to remember that some acute medicine units are really struggling, and they're staffed with mainly locums, and maybe, you know, it's in essentially pretty much all people who are dipping in and out, and locums, and, you know, then they're going to be struggling in all sorts of different areas as well. And so when we're setting targets for places, such as having enhanced care and everything like that, we need to bear that in mind for all bits of this, is that we've got to try and make these targets achievable, even for the units that are really struggling with staffing. Back on your workforce bit, Damien, 48% of advertised posts were unfilled. So we've got a workforce issue with consultants as well as with nursing staff and all members of the MDT.
We do. We definitely do.
So we're doing great things, and perhaps getting into an argument about whether somebody is truly an acute physician or not, when we've got 48% of posts unfilled, is not a...
It's not the right argument.
Not right now.
Yeah, exactly.
But at the same time, I think we need to sit back, be really proud of our acute medicine training, which is phenomenal, and getting better and better. And I think that will solve itself with time. Because, look, we're not struggling to fill our registrar posts, are we? People want to do acute medicine. It's an amazing training program. I think that will settle itself down with time. It's just because we're such a young specialty at the moment.
But we can't have a podcast without a bit of...
No, we need an argument.
Controversy. cause some arguments, stir up a bit of debate. So the other thing as well, that... you mentioned, Pete, with the coding, and what this could lead to is collecting data, allowing us to have certain set goals, times, percentages, things like that, and the coding will probably help with that as well. But there is quite a lot here that that we could work from with activity data is the section that I'm talking about in the GERF report, of things that we can collect. Has anybody else had a better look at that in terms of the coding, Peter?
Yeah, I did look at it, and it does talk about getting real-time timestamps on various interventions. So, for example, time it takes for a patient to see a senior decision maker or a consultant, and so on and so forth. And I think there's a lot of work to go into that, working with NHS digital terminology and things, and getting those systems in place. And I think that certainly is going to take time. And I think with all these recommendations, they give a time scale as well. And I think some of those timescales are very appropriate and need to be actioned immediately, and then some within 3 months and 6 or 12 months. And I think some of them are quite ambitious. And I think getting all trusts at the same level with regards to getting those like electronic whiteboards, if you like, and getting those timestamps in place, I don't know. I feel like that's going to take a bit more time, because, but it's going to collect so much data that would be so useful for the trust, and that data can then be audited and fed back in how they can improve their own system and processes.
So interestingly, I seen yesterday when you're talking about this, an advertisement going out for a GERF lead for the hospital, who sits on the medical directors under the Associate Medical Director Group Board. And has any other hospitals got that in place yet, the GERF leads, to look at these different GERF reports for the
as
different specialties?
As in a GERF lead for the whole hospital?
So it was advertised as a GERF lead for the whole hospital, and then they're going to have their sub-leads for each of the different specialties or each of the different GERF reports that are coming out. I've noticed that, which I think potentially could be a good thing for the hospital.
If all these recommendations were followed through, it'd be an amazing thing, wouldn't it? And this, if this is the sort of power, because I'm not sure about you guys, but I feel like the only power for change at the moment is a 12-hour trolley breach.
Yeah.
And it feels like there's so much common sense stuff that just doesn't happen purely because, well, it's not going to affect immediately the 12-hour trolley breach, therefore it doesn't get done. So if this is another way of implementing some change, it'd be amazing.
Yeah, and possibly what we do need is, although it's outside the scope of this, one is looking at the GERF reports for care of the elderly, social care, that type of thing, and not just looking at a 12-hour breach times or percentages at the front door.
So I'm looking at the time, and we need to sadly wrap up because I think we could probably spend another hour dissecting this.
That's 150 pages.
Yeah. So I think what I do is, they don't get put off by the number of pages. You can flip through it and keep flipping through it. And if you're working in acute medicine, you will find this interesting.
There's nice boxes and recommendations as well.
Yeah.
That are easy to read.
And it should be something I think you're discussing with your department, with the management there, with the MDT there, your nursing staff colleagues, because it is going to be helpful and it is sort of putting into context a lot of what we're already feeling. And we haven't even touched on some of the graphs where people are languishing in ED because the number of beds becoming available at certain times of the day is bigger than the number of people moving out, and that lake of despair when people are sort of stuck in ED. And there's the fairly recent document that talked about the something like 1 in 67 or something like that is the number needed to harm for a patient that spends longer in ED than they need to. So there's loads of stuff in here. They also start talking about sentinel conditions and whether we should have like national pathways for those things. So they've got the top 10 sentinel conditions that you can go and have a little look at as well. So I think to summarise, I would say it's a really well-written, well-researched document that's massively important for us as acute physicians. Go away and have a little read. As usual, we'll put it on the show notes. Yeah, don't... let's end with a positive. There's so much really good work going on that actually I think we should be proud, as we said, of being acute physicians and what we're actually achieving despite all the current pressures. Do you want to end with any other positives, you two?
I think it's quite good that it's there. It highlights acute medicine even more than we already do, and it brings acute medicine to the forefront at the moment in hospitals as well, with this GERF report coming out. So I think it'll be a good thing, definitely.
Peter?
No, I agree. I think it is a really, really interesting read, which I learned a lot from, and I'd recommend it to everyone who works in acute medical units, the whole workforce, as you said, Vicky.
I agree with that, because it's not just for us as consultants, junior doctors. There's lots in it about nursing care, AHP care. It's for the full MDT to sit down and discuss it as a full team.
Yeah, and we might all interpret it differently, so it's important that we all discuss it rather than just read it. Okay, well, thanks ever so much for your time, team. Peter, I hope you get better soon.
Thank you very much.
It's apparently not the dreaded COVID, but, the lateral flow might change everything. And thank you very much, Damien.
Thank you, Vicky.
Thanks, everybody. Goodbye.
Thank you all for listening to another episode of the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. We hope this episode has been interesting and helpful for you all. Please do go to the SAM website at www.acutemedicine.org.uk for all things acute medicine, including show notes from today's episode under the education menu. You will also find more info about acute medicine, the team, and how to contact us individually. Please do get in touch with us via Twitter using @acutemedpod and let us know what you thought, as well as topics you'd love to see us explore in future episodes, or if you'd like to just get involved. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you join us next time. Thank you all for listening to another episode of the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. We hope this episode has been interesting and helpful for you all. Please do go to the SAM website at www.acutemedicine.org.uk for all things acute medicine, including show notes from today's episode under the education menu. You will also find more info about acute medicine, the team, and how to contact us individually. Please do get in touch with us via Twitter using @acutemedpod. And let us know what you thought, as well as topics you'd love to see us explore in future episodes, or if you'd like to just get involved. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you join us next time.